Welcome to 2011 Warbirds in Review, and this is obviously about Bob Hoover. We wouldn't have all these throngs of people here. What we're going to try to do today is Bob has flown numerous airplanes, as everybody knows, but we're going to kind of concentrate on the Strike Commander and the P-51. And we also want to mention that the Fokker 190 that is over here that Rudy Frasca had restored. Actually, I guess it's a replication. But he's got a story about escaping from Germany in a Fokker 190. So anyway, we want to introduce the people that have actually owned the airplanes here. Old Yellow over here, which that's the original airplane. It's owned by John Bagley. Sean Bagley flew it in here. He's a corporate pilot. He also flies the P-63. He's a corporate pilot. I'm sorry? And also the Strike Commander, Bob Odegaard. Here's Bob, and Bob is a race pilot at Reno. And so I want to recognize both of these people. Go ahead, sit down. Okay. Now, Bob, let's just start off. How was it that you actually started into this demonstration flight, with a 51 and a Strike Commander?
Well, the answer to the Commander flights were an merger with Rockwell Corporation and North American Aviation. We were building Sabreliner and mostly military aircraft, and they were building the Aero Commander and a fleet of agricultural airplanes for crop dusting, and they had a business jet also. And when the merger took place, the president of the company and the board of directors invited me to go evaluate all of the airplanes. They had a bunch of research airplanes. They were under construction, planning on flight testing. And I had to make the decision for the company on whether we'd go forward with some of those designs or not. And I turned thumbs down on some of the airplanes. I said, you've got another Me Too airplane, and that isn't going to sell. There's already other airplanes on the marketplace. I said, go to an advanced design that'll give you more speed or something in it that would have an advantage over the competition. So I said, go rent some airplanes of the different types that were similar to what we were building, and evaluated them. And, well, the Aerostar was, for one, it was a faster airplane than the Strike was, and had the same power plants. So it was a step in advance. So why build another airplane, a Me Too type airplane? Build one that can sell. And so it got started that way, but I had demonstrated P-38s in War II, and the Aero Commander Act that I developed was all I had to worry about was the amount of G that I was pulling, because a P-38 was a 7.3G airplane, and when you drop it down to 4 G's, that changes your whole profile. Energy management is the trick to the whole thing, and with a 4G airplane, I found out on one of my early shows. I was going down to the dedication of the Stafford Airport, named after Stafford, who was an astronaut. And I was holding 3 G's, and I ran through. I did a perfectly round loop, and I hit my own jet wash, pop wash, and as a result, it went right up to 4 G's, and that gave me concern because it's not designed for any more than that. So I then decided that I had to start milking the mouse with kid gloves, and that is seeing how gently I could fly the airplane, limiting myself to 2 G's. And so that's where the management control took place, and we had maybe 2 acres of airplanes unsold, somewhat faded paint and half flat tires, and we were losing $13,000 a year on the airplanes. And it turns out after my first show we sold 3 airplanes, and it just evolved from there, and we ended up with a 2-year backlog. And my friend Lee Bailey's in the audience here, and he had a distributorship, and I don't know how many airplanes Lee sold himself, but we sold an awful lot of them, and we went from 1 airplane a month to, I think, maybe 8 or 9 airplanes per month, and we were sold out for 3 years in advance. So we turned it into a profitable company where it was losing money to making money, and then when we started making enough, we sold it off to Al Paulson.
Well, Bob, would you tell your story about the time that you went in to pick up fuel and they put the wrong fuel in the airplane?
Well, I was taking off from Brownfield, which is down on the Mexican border near San Diego, and you can see across the border from Brownfield. And there's a deep gorge that goes west to east, or east to west, and I'd asked this young man on the flight line, I said, I'm going to be on a short fuse time-wise, so when I finish flying the strike, I would sure appreciate it if you'd put on X number of gallons of fuel for the next day. And he said, yes, sir, I will. Well, I needed to leave that afternoon, and I got in the airplane, and it was serviced, and some people there that were going with me had gotten in the airplane and watched it be serviced, but the truck had no labeling on it as to what kind of fuel it was. And the young man put jet fuel in the airplane and didn't know it, and certainly I didn't know it. I was in the air when he serviced it, and I taxied out for takeoff, and I was about maybe 50 or 60 airplanes ahead of me, and I just got in line, and somebody said, why don't you put Mr. Hoover in front? And then everybody started saying the same thing, and I had planned on just taking my turn like everybody else. But the tower said, nobody's going to move until you go ahead and take off, so you're holding up everybody. So I went ahead and took off. And if I'd stayed in line, those engines would have quit, and I'd not had this accident. But that's the way life goes. I took off, and you can't believe this. Everything looked good. RPM, manifold pressure, temperatures, yet I had no power. I couldn't believe it. I just checked everything, but was no airspeed, and I couldn't get a rate of climb, and I had to stay on glide speed. Well, with staying on the glide speed, I had no place to go. I couldn't turn back. I wasn't high enough. And so I went down in this ravine. And to show you how sometimes if you think ahead outside of the box, you may think of something that you will remember in an emergency and save your life. I went down in this ravine. It had a dead end, and it was about 3 miles long. And I had plenty of glide speed, and I stayed right in there like so. And I had thought about it when I was flying the Yellowbird back and forth across the country and over the Rockies. And I had always figured, what if I had an engine failure in this Mustang and I was in mountainous terrain? How could you possibly survive? And I had thought about, get the gear down at the last minute and take it in on a 45-degree angle like this, and then stall it right into the ground. And so that's exactly what I did. And, of course, the people in the airplane, there were 2 of them, both of them pilots, and they said, we aren't going to survive it, are we? And I said, I kind of think we just have a real good chance. And I got it that I hit, and it crunched the landing gear, of course, and then I hit a rock pile, and it stopped rather abruptly and wrinkled it all the way back through the baggage compartment. And the instrument panel was down on my shins, as well as the fellow that was sitting in the right seat. And I got out, and the only injury was a snake that happened to be in the wrong place, and we hit right on top of him. Well, I thought, what in the world could have caused those engines to quit at the same time like that? And I ran up underneath the wing, and the gear was collapsed, and one engine was twisted down, and I hit the drain valve, and sure enough, I let out some fuel, and it was JP fuel. That was the cause of the accident. As a result, they came up with a nozzle that could be fitted onto the wing and onto the truck. And all trucks were labeled thereafter. And he'd just gotten in a truck. I had trouble finding some security people, and being that close to the border, I anticipated they would steal all of the radios and what gear wasn't damaged out of the airplane. And I got a hold of a security company to put guards around it. Being that close to the Mexican border, it would have been nothing left. Nevertheless, it turns out that I was waiting to get through to somebody, and I said, by the way, where's the young man that serviced my airplane? And he said, oh, he's outside. I said, would you be kind enough to bring him in? And so somebody went out and brought the young man into the facility there, and I put my arms around his shoulders, and I said, I know you didn't misfuel this airplane purposely. And I could see some tears in his eyes. I said, I want you to know that we've all made mistakes, and fortunately for both of us, nobody was injured to any degree here, and I want you to service my airplane tomorrow. Well, I felt very good about that. I'd sure like to. I'll bet you anything in the world, whatever he's doing at this point in his life, he's going to be a success, because he was very emotional about it, and I really felt strongly that nobody should say anything unkind to him.